Hailed as the new Pete Seeger, folk singer, songwriter, and activist David Rovix has brought his powerful blend of music, humor, and political commentary to Vancouver. Since the mid-90s, Rovix has spent most of his time on tour, playing concerts and rallies around the U.S., Canada, and Europe. He shared the stage with many leading activists, including Amy Goodman, Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Angela Davis, Billy Bragg, and many others. I caught up with David just before his show tonight in the green room in the behind the Wise Hall to talk about music, politics, and social change. Hi, David. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Chris.
I spoke with you last in Oregon, and now you've crossed the border into Canada. And I was going to ask you how the tour was going, but I understand there's a little bit of a complication at the border.
Well, yeah, the tour's been going just great, and you know, the border crossing was a bit of a glitch. I mean, the main problem being that I wasn't able to come here with any CDs or with my guitar, but the guitar can be, you know, there's other good guitars here, so, and luckily somebody else had a sound system to use, so it all worked out more or less, but they wouldn't let me cross the border with my guitars and CDs.
Yeah, everybody kind of like spontaneously mobilized and brought all those things together for you. And so I'm really looking forward to the outcome of all that. We'll hopefully be able to broadcast some of that on Co-op Radio sometime later.
Yeah, yeah, it's all good. I think the sound system we got here is, well, not quite as good as mine, but it's fine, and it'll all work out just fine, yeah.
Great. So Lynch launched right into music and movement building. Your visit to Vancouver coincides with momentum, the efforts to build momentum for the March 20th International Anti-War Movement. And I'm wondering if you can say how music, what role music has in social movement building.
I think it has it has many roles to play, and many of the roles that it has to play are really the same roles that music plays in society generally. And one of the roles is inspiring people into action, and inspiring people into feeling a sense of community. You know, the sort of go get 'em kind of songs. You know, and that is really, I mean, it goes way far back, long before you know, the modern capitalist society. But it's the same sorts of ways that, you know, the way we use music to foster a sense of community and togetherness, and it's really the same ways that military uses music when they're marching, the way that corporations use music to sell their products. It's really basically that there's that angle of music as something to bring people together, to create, you know, memorable songs that people associate with causes, to sort of, and also to distill ideas into simple and memorable, you know, snippets of so that there's the educational quality as well. You know, the quality, the aspect of telling people about something they might not know, or presenting a perspective that's like a, you know, a basics perspective that you hope people will share, and, you know, has, you know, many different roles to play, I think.
And your music explores a wide range of themes, ending Israeli occupation of Palestine, U.S. occupation of Iraq, even visionary themes, life after revolution. I'm wondering if you could explain or how you would characterize the difference between your range of themes and then the themes in mainstream commercial music.
Yeah, well, I mean, mainstream commercial music, I think largely because of the influence of the record industry, is limited to a huge extent to songs about relationships between two individuals, usually heterosexual, and, you know, they're usually really kind of pointless little themes, like, you know, how many times can you say, you know, all night long in a song? You know, there's so many songs about staying up all night long. It's just amazing how many times they can rehash these themes. They're so tired, and but that's what the record industry wants people to listen to, and that's what they want to promote. And part of it probably has to do with, like, lowest common denominator stuff, like everybody can relate to love and relationships, and that's true to some extent. But I think everybody can relate, or the vast majority can relate, to all kinds of other topics as well. And I think it's basically a political decision on the part of the music industry not to promote that kind of music that says something about other aspects of life than love, or in between two people. And you know, the themes that I explore and other songwriters who are not beholden to the music industry explore are just you know, what's happening in the world, what are people doing, what's life like. You know, I mean, people, life involves relationships for sure, and that's a fine subject, but life also involves, you know, work or unemployment or, you know, police brutality or getting drafted or getting cancer or you know, it's all just, you know, all kinds of other things that are faced by people all the time, you know, losing their whole community to some, you know, mining company or to their factory being exported to some place where they can exploit the workers even more. I mean, you know, this is what is going on in our societies, and this is what I think many people write about, and a lot of it just doesn't get on the airwaves except on something like Co-op Radio, but, you know,
You've written that music can be more than an escape, and you paraphrase Bertolt Brecht saying it can also be a hammer. Can you elaborate on this phrase?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, music, I think, you know, people have often said, who were participants in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, that as they were marching through the streets with crowds of racist wackos, you know, throwing stuff at them, and they're marching towards the lines of the racist police and their German shepherds getting ready to, you know, tear gas them and beat them and bite them, you know, that the kind of bravery that was required to keep on marching and going towards those lines of cops would not have been able to be maintained, people have said, without the fact that they were all singing together. And I think, you know, that's basically what I'm getting at, that music is something that can hold us together like glue and allow us to act collectively better than we could without music. And that's the sort of hammer effect that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm.
So where do your songs come from?
Oh, well, they come from just observing the world around me. That's part of where they come from. But ultimately, I think, you know, it's sort of similar to like method acting in a sense. They also come from my own personal experience, although most of the songs I'm writing are not necessarily about my personal experience, like, you know, some song like, you know, about a firefighter in New York or a firefighter in Kabul or some family in Iraq that's, you know, dying of malnutrition in Basra or just any number of other situations. It's not stuff that I've actually experienced myself, but to some extent, the songs all come from my own experience as well. They come from, there's always some kind of connection. I think any time you're writing something, if you're going to do it well, there has to be some way that you're empathizing with whoever or whatever you're writing about, and some way that you can draw on your own experience. And if you're writing about something that involves grief, then, you know, hopefully you're drawing on your own grief. If you're writing about anger, you're drawing on your own anger. If you're writing about love, you know, you're drawing on your own love. So there's, you know, an aspect of, you know, I'm writing about things I'm reading in the paper, but I'm also writing about my own outlook, my own experiences as well through that.
There's one song, the song Bird Sings. Can you tell us how that song came about?
Yeah, I was listening to a wonderful show on that's broadcast on a couple different Pacifica stations in California and Texas, called Flashpoints from Berkeley, and Dennis Bernstein, the host, was interviewing somebody with the International Solidarity Movement who was in Gaza, and was with the family of this 10-year-old boy who was shot in the back 4 times by Israeli soldiers for the crime of catching songbirds to sell on the market and try to feed his family. And he made the mistake of catching the songbirds where the songbirds live, which is in the ancient olive groves within 1,000 meters or so from the border with between Gaza and Israel, the arbitrary border that Israel says is their border. And you know, that's where the songbirds are. That's where you got to go to catch them. But you're always risking being killed by the Israeli soldiers if you are a child walking around in that area.
I think it takes a tremendous amount of skill to be able to translate a story like that into a song that hits people in the heart and then ignites emotion and action. How did that skill evolve for you?
Well, I guess for me, it's, I mean, part of it is that it's just something, it's just a craft, and when you do it and you work at it and you try to be honest with yourself about what's working and what's not, and try to emulate other people who do it well, you know, you get good at it, just like if you are studying plumbing or you know, sound engineering or any number of other crafts, you know, you do it enough, you get good at it if you're not completely blind to, you know, what's working and what's not working. You know, maybe it's a little more straightforward with something like plumbing, because obviously if it works, then stuff doesn't leak, and if it doesn't work, then stuff leaks. So there's that. But also, so there's that aspect, and then also, I guess for me, what I'm drawing on a lot is really what really sort of changed my life and changed my songwriting was when my close friend and housemate in 1993 was shot to death in San Francisco. And that really introduced me to a level of grief and feelings of that things were very wrong in our society and really needed to change. And it just gave me a more personal identification with the horrors that are, you know, present throughout modern U.S. society. And for me, it was interesting. Like, you know, there Eric was shot to death in the Mission District, which is primarily a neighborhood populated by Central American refugees, and it was really the experience just after he died, and being in the depths of the grief that I experienced for years afterwards, wandering around the streets of the Mission District and seeing the faces of these Central American refugees and realizing, like, seeing that familiarity in their faces for the first time, like, oh, they've been through things like this, only, you know, far more often and far worse, and that was, if I had to pick one experience, that was a seminal experience that informed my songwriting, that was it.
I think your music has allowed many people who listen to it to be able to empathize with people in other parts of the world, in parts of their cities that they don't go to often, or maybe come across issues that shock them and they're not aware about. I think it's allowed them to empathize with those stories and those experiences as well. Before going on tour, you spent a lot of time in subways busking. How did that impact your evolution as a songwriter?
Oh yeah, playing in the subways is just a great thing to do, and it's first of all, it's a great way to get lots of practice every day, because, you know, normally if you're a full-time touring performer, your concerts probably aren't going to be more than 2 hours, so you're not going to be playing more than 2 hours a day unless you're, you know, doing some practicing and in the midst of the touring and everything, or when you're not touring. But in the subways, you're going to play 4 or 5 hours a day, because you got to make a living. And so you're going to, you know, get a lot of practice. So that's one aspect of it that's really positive. And then also, you know, depending on which subway and which city, and you're basically more or less playing for a cross-section of the population of the city that you're in, which is very different than playing for, like, a typical folk audience or playing for a typical activist audience, you know, where you're playing for a certain demographic, more or less. And, you know, in the subways in Boston, you're just playing for everybody that comes on the subways. And so you really get to see, like, you know, where are people at musically and politically, and how do they feel about things, about this kind of music, you know, what are they... And one of the things that it really helped me realize, of course, I've had lots of other experiences that have helped me to realize this, but at least in urban U.S., most people are really progressive, and it's really obvious when you play music about radical subjects, and people really identify with it and they resonate with it. They give you money, they buy CDs, and you know, you can find that out in lots of other ways. I mean, try walking around any urban area in the U.S. wearing George Bush is an international terrorist T-shirt, and you just find how, you know, everybody's constantly coming up and saying, "Hey, man, that's great. Where can I get that T-shirt?" Or "Yeah, right on," or whatever. And it just, you know, it's you really find out where people are at that way.
You've produced many songs and albums. You've played at many demonstrations and rallies, and this movement that we participate in does have lots of momentum, lots of uncertainties as well. Where do you see challenges, and what do you see as goals?
Well, I think, I guess I'd say that, I mean, of course, all the rallies are great, and they're my favorite places to play. But generally, I'd say in terms of the movement, the goal, as far as I'm concerned, is to continue to build counter institutions, like continue to for people like me to continue to perform, for people like you to continue to build community radio stations, for college professors to keep on teaching, for people who are doing web development for radical websites to keep on doing that, and for the organizers to keep on organizing, you know, and for us to keep on building the movement a bit by bit. But you know, it's not necessary to have illusions about the idea that just building things bit by bit is suddenly going to result in a mass change. But mass change can happen any second. You never know. I mean, and the rulers of the U.S. are terrified of this possibility, and you can see how they are so calculating in everything they do in order to make sure to prevent the possibility of really messing up, so that we have the opportunity to jump through the window there and change things. But, you know, most people in the U.S. are cynical and disillusioned, and they feel helpless, you know. And those are two of those qualities are really positive, and the last one isn't. But the thing is that when somebody feels a personal identification with something, like, you know, of course, like in the case of the Vietnam War, when the body bags keep on coming home, that, you know, more and more people develop a personal identification with this, like, war being bad. This is why, of course, they do their best to prevent too many body bags, and if they do come home, they don't show them on television. Bush never attends a funeral. But there's different things that can happen that can set off the population, whether it's some massive corporate or government scandal or a war or, you know, terrorist attacks or whatever might do it, that people can get set off. And when they do, I think the job of the movement is to be there, to have the infrastructure in place, so that when stuff happens, we're ready to be that infrastructure that people can turn to rely on. You know, I mean, and it can happen anywhere. It can happen in the First World or the Third World. Of course, it happens more often in the Third World. But, you know, because obviously people have more reason to personally identify with struggle because they're suffering so much, you know. But, you know, in a place like Bolivia, you know, with the recent overthrow of the government there, this wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been an infrastructure of indigenous and peasants and workers and women's organizations on the ground that were already there, and where the infrastructure was in place, the skeleton was there. And so when the masses of people in Bolivia became, you know, mobilized because of the outrages the government was doing with selling off their natural resources to the U.S. for a song, they hit the streets. And when they hit the streets, it wasn't just like random rioting, it was organized revolt. And the reason why it was organized was because the infrastructure for the movement already existed, you know, even if the movement itself didn't exist to the extent that it did, you know, in recent months, the basic skeleton of it existed. So when, you know, that skeleton had muscle on its bones, it could move, you know.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's been a great experience to have this discussion with you.
Thank you, Chris.
I've been speaking with David Rovics. You can find out more about David and his music at davidrovics.com.